This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Catherine Graham. Coming up, Australia sends more help to Fiji as it grapples with a growing COVID-19 crisis. There's great anticipation for this year's global climate talks, but how united will the Pacific be? And we'll hear about concerns in Vanuatu that the tradition of bride price is being abused by some, as people have lost their main source of income because of the COVID-19 pandemic. First to Fiji, though, where the COVID-19 crisis reached multiple grim milestones this week, including more than 1,200 new infections in a single day. Community transmission in the small Pacific Island nation is now uncontrolled, prompting Australia and New Zealand to send a second team of medical experts to help. The health system is being stretched to its limit. Multiple field hospitals have been set up to accommodate the sick, while morgues are filling up. More than 24 people have died in the past week alone, as Kelvin Anthony reports.
A fortnight ago, Lepani Rayala lost his partner to COVID-19, and this week he couldn't attend her funeral in person because he's also infected with the highly infectious Delta strain of the virus and is isolating at a COVID care facility in the capital, Suva.
The fact that I'm not able to make it and to be there to perform one last thing for her, you know, one last service for her before she goes, just to carry her body, to not being able to do that, and just I'm going to be watching on Zoom, helpless. That hurts a lot.
Marie Stewart was just 39, a popular radio personality and a well-liked figure. She was also obese, which studies globally have shown would have put her at much higher risk of severe illness. But her death has left many in shock, including Patricia Malam, who was Marie's childhood best friend. She says the woman she considered as a sister just wanted things to get back to normal.
Because she was always so full of life. She just got along with everybody.
After receiving her AstraZeneca jab in mid-June, Ms. Stewart encouraged others to also get vaccinated. But 2 weeks ago, she tested positive to COVID-19, which is now widespread on Fiji's main island, Viti Levu. She was admitted to hospital on a Saturday, had difficulties breathing on Sunday, and by Monday, the situation had changed quickly.
The last message I got, which was, thank you for everything, and I just wanted to tell you that I love you all. I just can't believe how quickly it happened. Like, Friday she tells me she's positive, and on Monday she's gone.
Fiji's current wave began in April, after a breach in the country's hotel quarantine system. Since then, the number of infections has surged past 12,000, and almost 100 people have died after contracting the virus. Mass vaccinations is the government's go-to strategy, but health authorities warn that there will be growing cases and deaths in the weeks ahead. The morgue at the main hospital has already reached capacity. Two more refrigerated shipping containers have been brought in to cater for an additional 100 dead bodies should the need arise. Maurice Ruggiero runs a local crematorium and expects the demand for his services will increase in a month's time.
I think it's early days. You know, there will be obviously people passing away in large numbers. We may be having a totally different conversation in another, you know, 3-4 weeks from now.
So far, the majority of the people who've died from COVID-19 were unvaccinated, but 12 had received their first dose. Dr. Rachel Devi, the head of Fiji's vaccination task force, says no one who has been fully vaccinated has succumbed to the virus.
We've seen people who have died and who had received one jab had just been vaccinated like just a week ago or 2 weeks ago. And that's not enough time for someone's immune system to come up to par to, you know, prevent the severe disease.
The majority of Fiji's AstraZeneca vaccines are being donated by Australia, which has pledged 1 million in total, with 390,000 doses already delivered. The Fijian Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama expects every eligible person will have had at least one dose by mid-August, and he hopes everyone will be fully vaccinated by November. Authorities are battling some vaccine hesitancy, but Lepani Rayala hopes his story and that of his partner Marie will serve as a lesson for many.
I was one of the people that used to think that it's just the flu, but it's not just the flu. The symptoms that you get is far painful. Oh, you and your throat is sore. It gets to the point it feels like you're swallowing needles. People are complaining about wearing a mask, it's hard to breathe. It is nothing compared to when you're on a bed and you're struggling for air and you've got the oxygen mask on you and you're still struggling.
That's Lapani Rayala ending that report from Kelvin Anthony. Well, a group of Papua New Guinean students studying here in Australia fear they won't be able to return home under new travel restrictions imposed by their government. The rules require anyone travelling into PNG to be fully vaccinated, and when they arrive, they also have to quarantine for 21 days at their own expense. Some students say the requirements make it virtually impossible to return home before their visas expire. Marion Farr reports.
Completing a PhD should be a cause for celebration. A Papua New Guinean scholar who doesn't want his real name used, but who we'll call Quentin, just finished his thesis at an Australian university. He's been studying there for 4 years and has finally come to the end of his doctorate. But instead of being able to relax after all his hard work, he's found himself in an extremely difficult situation.
My biggest worry, not just myself, but for most people, especially the students, is financial burden, which may lead to stress.
Quinton is one of more than 4,000 students who were granted an Australia Award scholarship in 2017. The program is funded by the Australian government to support people from developing countries to study at university in Australia. Now that he's finished and his Australian visa expires in a few weeks, Quinton is due to return to PNG. But that's proving difficult under new travel restrictions imposed by the PNG government this month in response to global outbreaks of the highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19, including in Australia's biggest city, Sydney. The new rules say that anyone travelling to PNG from overseas must be fully vaccinated. They also have to quarantine in a hotel for 21 days at their own expense. Quinton says that's likely to cost more than 20,000 kina.
I can't afford it. I can't pay for it. And I've already faced a lot of financial issues and challenges. Then I've started asking my friends to borrow their money to get loans and to cover for things here.
Quinton has already had one dose of Pfizer and is due for his second in a few weeks. But he says some other students won't be able to get both vaccines before their Australian visas expire. He says that's especially the case for those who have taken AstraZeneca, which had recommendations of a longer wait time between doses.
In order to complete the vaccination, the window or the time frame to complete the vaccination couldn't meet the minimum period for some of us. The visa expired or will expire.
Just yesterday, Australia's expert panel on vaccines changed its advice and said people in outbreak areas can have their second dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine 4 weeks after their first. Quentin and other students met virtually over the weekend to discuss the issue and put a request to the PNG government for special consideration. Quentin says PNG authorities should allow students back into PNG with just one dose of the vaccine and look at ways to cover their hotel quarantine costs.
Well, the government couldn't neglect its own citizens. Maybe the students, they're going there to study. And these are the future, you know, possible HR or human resources that could contribute to the country.
Papua New Guinea's COVID-19 Deputy Controller, Dr. Esarom Downey, says the ramped up restrictions are necessary.
If you cannot pay for it, then my advice is to stay out of PNG because at the moment we need to protect our country. We cannot allow the Delta variant to come in.
But he says students can apply to the government for assistance.
You put your application in, then we'll assess your application on their own merit. And if you are a student, we'll fully understand the situation and then we'll help, we'll try our best to help them out.
That's PNG's COVID-19 Deputy Controller, Dr. Esarom Downey, ending Marianne Farr's report with additional reporting by Belinda Cora. And the ABC has asked the Australian government what it's doing to help Australia Award scholars but has not received a response. Well, global climate talks to be held in Glasgow at the end of the year are said to be the most important since the Paris Agreement was struck and the world united to limit global warming. Pacific representatives played an important role in getting that agreement over the line. but it's unclear if they'll be able to have the same influence this year due to the disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Liam Fox reports.
Former Miss Solomon Islands, now climate advocate Gladys Harbu, wants to be in Glasgow in November for this year's Global Climate Talks, known by their acronym COP26.
I would really love to go, but I don't know yet if I'm going. I think it will definitely depend on whether I get selected to represent my country and also the availability of funding to send a group of people across. I mean, Glasgow is several flight destinations away from us, and with all these COVID restrictions in place, I think that's going to be a bit difficult.
She says it's important the Pacific is well represented at the negotiations.
The Pacific Island countries are very much at the front line of this climate crisis. We contribute very little to the increase in greenhouse gas emissions, and yet we are still underrepresented most of the time at these international events. So it'll be very important if we have more representation at this COP so that people understand the reality that we are facing on the ground here.
The Pacific Climate Action Network, PCAN, also wants to send representatives. The network's Lave Tanalangi Seru says they have just put out a call for people to take part in their Climate Justice Summit next month in preparation for COP26.
To build this unified and inclusive Pacific regional voice that will, advocate and campaign, and also push for human rights and climate justice in lead up to COP26.
But he too says getting Pacific Islanders to Glasgow could be difficult.
COVID-19 has made things a lot more harder in terms of participation. And, we've been consulting with members. We've received reports already of, certain Pacific Island countries, the governments have made high-level decisions not to attend COP26 in person.
Dr. Wesley Morgan is an expert on climate politics at Griffith University and says this year's talks are perhaps the most important since the Paris Agreement was struck in 2015 when governments agreed to set carbon emission reduction targets.
The significance of COP26 is it's really a test of the Paris Agreement. Are countries going to make new commitments?
He says Pacific representatives bring a moral voice to climate negotiations and have played an influential role in the past, such as the Marshall Islands did in Paris.
The Marshall Islands Foreign Minister, Tony de Broom, led a high ambition coalition, which became a grouping of 100-plus countries in Paris. And really the Pacific was crucial for securing that global agreement.
But the notion of Pacific regionalism, a united Pacific, has taken a battering in recent times. The most glaring example is the threat by the leaders of Micronesian countries to exit the Pacific Islands Forum after their nomination for the position of Secretary General was unsuccessful. So even if a sizable Pacific cohort does make it to Glasgow, will they speak with one voice? Dr. Morgan thinks so.
The Pacific can be fractious, but over the past couple of decades, the Pacific, the one thing that they have had a unified position on is their demands in the global climate talks at the United Nations.
Lave Tanalangi Seru from PCAN says there may be division among regional governments on some issues, but civil society groups remain united.
With respect to civil society organisations that we are working with, I think the tempo, the momentum is still there in terms of a sense of that solidarity and togetherness and, being unified in some of the regional issues that are being discussed, including climate justice.
Gladys Harbu recently took part in a virtual meeting of regional leaders organised by the United Kingdom and led by COP26 President Alok Sharma. She says they remain united on climate change despite recent political division. During the talks, she urged the leaders to declare a climate emergency ahead of COP26.
If we did that before COP26, it will send a very, very, very powerful message to the rest of the world regarding how much we are affected by the climate crisis.
That's Solomon Islands climate advocate Gladys Harbu ending Liam Fox's report. Political observers in Tonga say they're concerned an education funding scandal could affect the country's international reputation. A Tongan government minister and her husband were convicted for misappropriating money from an Australian-funded vocational education program, and they'll spend up to 6 years in prison after being caught in what the judge said was a highly devised plan. Nick Fogarty has the story.
Tonga's Minister for Infrastructure and Tourism, Makosita Lavu-Lavu, and her husband, Eduate Lavu-Lavu, have both been jailed after being found guilty in the Supreme Court of obtaining money by false pretences. Makosita had no previous offences, but her husband, a former cabinet minister himself, was convicted of bribery in 2016 and forced to resign from Parliament. Their crimes involved the misappropriation of more than $550,000 from the Ministry of Education through making false claims about the correct number of students who are enrolled at the couple's educational institute. The former Minister for Infrastructure and Tourism, Samisi Sika, is promoting a petition calling for Akasita Lavu-Lavu to be impeached, and he says the court's decision is a sensible one.
All I can say is that it's just about time that we put people in proper position. They've been convicted, they've been proven guilty on this specific case. They have not shown any remorse or any regret, no attempt to pay the money they've misused, the tax and government funds they have misused over the years. And so I totally and fully agree with the ruling and the sentences that's been delivered.
The couple are appealing the decision, with the hearing set to take place at some point between September and March next year. Their application for bail was rejected, so they'll remain in prison for now. The case has drawn extra attention due to the origin of the misappropriated funds. They were applied for and received by the couple through the Tonga Technical Vocational Education Training Grant Program, which was funded by the Australian and New Zealand governments. Tavita Motulalu is a senior researcher at Tongan think tank the Royal Oceania Institute, and says the case makes for some awkward conversations with Tonga's development partners.
Australia's been very generous. These are hard-earned taxes from the people of Australia, and to abuse it like that is beyond description.
Tavita Motulalu says it's especially galling that even after the court's decision, Akasita Lavu-Lavu remains a cabinet minister.
It does affect our reputation and trustworthiness, especially with sitting ministers. If they continue to be ministers and they're already convicted of certain crimes, that's not a good look. It doesn't help our people. It doesn't help government. It doesn't help His Majesty's government.
The Speaker of Tonga's Parliament is Lord Whakawhanua, elected as a nobles' representative. He says while this case is particularly sensitive as it involves official foreign donor aid, the court's decision shows that Tonga's government system is essentially sound.
The fact remains our justice system worked and it picked up fraudulent behaviour, and you know all the funds must be held accountable in the end because they're public and taxpayers' money. And I think the fact that this has gone through our court system is evident of the fact that the system works in the end, even though the situation around it is highly unfortunate and regrettable.
That's the Speaker of Tonga's Parliament, Lord Whakawhanua, and Nick Fogarty reporting. And the ABC has sought comment from Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Well, getting married can certainly cost a lot, but in Vanuatu, it's not the wedding ceremony that's sending people into debt, but the traditional custom of bride price. Some families are forking out tens of thousands of vatu, which is thousands of Australian dollars, just to meet the demands of the new in-laws. And that's despite the fact that many people in Vanuatu have lost their main source of income because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And it means the country's traditional leaders, the Council of Chiefs, think that the demands are an abuse of the custom laws. Mavuku Takona has this story from Port Vila.
Thank you all the time. Every family welcome this morning.
A large crowd sits under a large mango tree. In front of them are piles of colourful woven mats. Bunches of sugarcane tower 3 metres into the air. And pigs lie with their legs bound. Some killed, the rest quietly grunting.
Payment logger, wife Lokiro, 20 plain mat, 2 feta mat, 5 wool mat, 1 pig.
These are the gifts being handed over by the groom's families to the brides in this traditional ceremony on Ifira Island. That's opposite Port Vila, but can only be accessed by boat. A total of 9 young couples are getting married, including Kiro Taiwia and Hitomi Ayong, who are dressed in a matching purple island shirt and island dress.
It wasn't too difficult for us because we believe that only God can solve everything. So we even thought we could see that everything is so small, but we believe in God that we can do anything through Him.
Both are 26 and have been together 6 years. They had a church ceremony a week earlier, but also taking part in a custom ceremony was important to both of them.
Okay, the thing for me is just to do with the family. So this is like exchange of relationship. So I'm going to come with nothing. So I have to come with something so that I can present myself to our family. So that's how we could join hands together as a family. In such a way, we have this small thing to say with us.
Kiro gave cash as well as a collection of mats, a pig, cassava, and sugarcane.
I paid my lovely wife 60,000.
60?
Yeah. And we have a son, and we have 5,000 for her, for him.
The island's chief, Mantoy Kalsakau III, says that the total amount was actually likely to be much higher.
More than 80,000. More than 80,000, because you count the value of mats and yams and only everything, more than 100,000. Yeah. Pigs and sugarcane, kava, yam, banana.
This tradition of bride price has long existed in Vanuatu. But in the modern era, the amounts transferred between families has grown excessively. That's previously concerned women's groups and churches, with studies showing that women whose marriage involved bride price are 2.5 times more likely to experience domestic violence. The country's Council of Chiefs, called Malvatu Māori, had previously set a limit of 80,000 vatu. That's around $1,000 Australian. But in 2005, it completely banned cash and encouraged people to give traditional currencies like pigs and mats instead. That's not been followed, though, even in this COVID-19 era, when many families are struggling to make ends meet. Jean-Pierre Tom is the chief executive officer of Malvatu Māori and says some families even appear to be demanding more money from their daughters who have further education.
Some people, for example, say, oh, I spent a lot of money with my girl.
Some people, for example, say, oh, I spent a lot of money on my daughter's education. She's been to very expensive school. And the time you take her and marry her, I lose.
Me lose. No, she's a woman.
But no, she is a woman. She has her rights, and custom does not mean you own her. She is not a material thing. She is a human being.
It's not a material thing, it's a human being.
But Chief Mantoy Kalsakau from Ifira Island says he has no control over what families are choosing to give.
But we can't tell anyone, pick. Custom marriage long here today. You don't expect them, say, my old family only give him more than 80,000.
With customs marriages, we don't expect families to give more than 80,000 vatu. It should be less than that. But it comes from the heart of families. I can't stop what families give.
Jean-Pierre Tom from Malvatu Māori says some people have been abusing the custom process by demanding high bride prices because of the tough financial situation they face.
People are abusing custom marriage in terms of custom interpretation and meaningful.
Jean-Pierre Tom from Vanuatu's Council of Chiefs, ending that report from Mavuku to Kona in Vanuatu. And that is all from Pacific Review this week. But don't forget, if you do enjoy listening to news about the Pacific, there's Pacific Beat, a daily program on ABC Radio Australia that you can find online or on the ABC Listen app as well. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks for listening.